American facilities and also military facilities. We are revenging all the violations have been committed against the Yemeni people since the March 2015, and we are very sure that we are now in the year of victory.
On a Friday, the Yemeni army launched fresh attacks against several targets in Saudi Arabia. The attacks caused a heavy blow to Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan and Najran, as well as Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries. The Yemeni army said it has also targeted vital sites in Riyadh with ballistic missiles.
People here say the 8th year of the war will be different, as the Yemeni army has already proven that it is capable of hitting Saudi targets, including its oil facilities. The Yemenis believe that Riyadh will eventually have to consider a political solution, at least to protect its oil giant Aramco in the face of Yemeni attacks. Avlatif Al-Washali, Sana.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression. In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the yellow vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun, an unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just 1 day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election.
France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Rahman Mazahiri, Paris.
In yet another act of Israeli aggression against the Palestinians of Gaza, Israeli planes sprayed toxic chemicals on the eastern perimeter of the coastal enclave. Israeli crop duster planes sprayed herbicides at least twice this week on Gaza farming areas. The Israeli regime regularly sprays Palestinian agricultural lands near the so-called buffer zone with dangerous substances which destroy the crops. For more than a decade, Israeli planes sprayed Gaza's farmlands several times a year, destroying various crops.
The Israelis spread herbicides to the farmers' land beside the border in order to prevent them to plant in their land, to bush the farmers out of their land and leave their land without any trees in order to feed them for their food security and for their children.
Spraying unknown toxic substances on Gaza's farmlands may have long-lasting effects on the environment. Gazan farmers say they are struggling to make ends meet due to Israel's inhumane practices.
Israel sprays our farmlands with poison. The chemicals that they spray don't kill the weed on the fence. They only kill our crops. We suffer heavy losses when Israel sprays our land because it's killing our crops and poisoning our farmlands.
Israel claims that it sprays what it described as weed killers for security reasons, but experts say the Israeli regime aims to destroy the livelihoods of farmers.
Using such herbicides on Gaza Strip by the Israelis, it's kind of offensive towards the Palestinian farmers. At the same time, towards the Palestinian food security, these areas are feeding the Palestinians with the needed vegetables and other kinds.
Rights groups say the suffering of farmers and their families in Gaza reflects the scope of Israeli human rights violations. Gazan farmers have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and war since 2007. Now experts say that Israel's poisoning of crops will make a bad situation worse and harm vital sources of food in the territory. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As the world's eyes are on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Saudi led war in Yemen is still taking the lives of more civilians and pushing the country to the brink of famine. A recent UN report says 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure, and the number is likely to go up to 19 million by the end of the year.
Unfortunately, the United Nations reports did not clarify the main reason for the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The only solution to end the humanitarian crisis is to lift the siege and allow Yemenis to import food and medicine.
Back in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen to bring back to power former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of people, including women and the children, have lost their lives since then.
I was sitting in my house with my children in the evening, and suddenly a missile struck the next house. The explosion destroyed my house as well. We were so afraid.
Saudi warplanes targeted our neighborhood. Look at the destruction. This is a crime, and unfortunately, the world's watching in silence.
The Saudi war has impacted all aspects of civilian lives in Yemen, including the healthcare system, which is on the verge of collapse. This comes amid the ongoing fuel shortage, as Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil ships, despite the fact that the vessels have UN permits.
We suffer from a severe lack of fuel. We cannot operate medical devices without electricity, not to mention the lack of medicines and medical solutions. There is overcrowding in the medical centers. Unfortunately, the United Nations did not provide us with anything other than media statements. The international community must stop Saudi Arabia from seizing Yemeni oil ships.
Children are the most affected people by Saudi Arabia's war. The rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world, and the situation continues to deteriorate.
More than a million children are suffering from malnutrition in Yemen, and I believe the number is greater than this. And we are coming to a worse period because we do not have the most basic needs necessary to save the lives of sick children, such as milk, solutions, and medicines.
Observers say the years-long Saudi war in Yemen has only created the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. They say years of failure should be enough for Riyadh to start looking for other means to get rid of the quagmire it stuck with its war in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
On Thursday, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian arrived in Beirut to hold talks with Lebanese officials. Abdollahian expressed his country's willingness to provide aid to Lebanon in different fields, especially in the economic and commercial sectors.
Almost a month ago, I met with Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mirati in the Munich summit, and I informed him about the Islamic Republic of Iran's readiness to assist Lebanon in building two power plants, where each would provide 1,000 megawatts of electricity. This is in addition to Tehran's readiness to cooperate with Lebanon in economic development and other fields.
Abdollahian met with top Lebanese officials to discuss bilateral ties as well as latest developments in the region. President Michel Aoun stressed during his meeting with the Iranian minister that any progress in the Vienna talks as well as negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia will have positive impact on the region and the world. During his talks with Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Birri and Prime Minister Miqati, Abdullahian touched upon the significance of the upcoming parliamentary elections in Lebanon. As Lebanon is dealing with economic crisis, some experts believe U.S. bans on any dealing with other Asian states, especially Iran, has exacerbated Lebanon's problems.
The U.S. pressure and the Western country against the Iranian commitment to help Lebanese people in supporting their living, of daily living, this is what prevents the Lebanese government from receiving the funds and the support of the Iranian people and Iranian government. As people and as local authorities in Ghubairi, we welcome for any support coming from the Iranian people, first of all, and the Iranian government for the sake of better survival.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah also held a meeting with the Iranian minister where they discussed developments in Lebanon and the region. Abdullahian met with Palestinian factions and reiterated Iran's support for the full liberation of Palestine. The Iranian foreign minister has reiterated the Islamic Republic of Iran's previous calls to build two electricity stations, which could substantially resolve Lebanon's energy crisis. However, Lebanese officials seem reluctant to face U.S. intimidations and work with Iran, or even China for that matter, to change Lebanon's dire conditions. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Due to the conflict in Ukraine and Western sanctions against Russia, it has never been more costly to buy essential food items in the European Union, and the situation is set to get much worse. The world's biggest wheat producer is Russia. The third largest is Ukraine.
Wheat is a very good example. When I say wheat, we are actually talking about bread to feed people.
In fact, wheat prices have risen by 70%. The European Commission has just unveiled plans to support food producers and reduce tax to 0% on certain food items. €330 million has been announced to support Ukrainian farmers.
They need, for the spring sowing campaign, they need 50,000 tons of fuel per week.
Animal feedstocks are on the decline. Campaigners say millions could starve in East Africa if EU leaders don't do more to help poorer nations. Syria and Yemen have also been singled out for needing special support.
There are, in fact, 14 low-income countries which depend for more than 50% of their wheat imports on these two countries, on Ukraine and Russia.
The European Commission has presented new legislation to make it mandatory for member states to ensure 80% gas reserves are put in place before November. Experts say that is wishful thinking. 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees have now arrived in the EU. Most countries in the bloc have failed to take in their fair share, but some already have.
Poland is in top. The country number two is Austria. The country number three is Cyprus. Country number four is Czech Republic.
Almost €3.5 billion has been set aside from the EU budget to support refugees, including 1,470 unaccompanied children who have arrived in the bloc from Ukraine. Some nations are saying it's simply not enough money. EU leaders will hold a summit here on Thursday and Friday to consider, amongst other things, a request from Poland for new funding towards the cost of dealing with the growing refugee crisis. All indications so far suggest that request will be rejected. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence, but it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, but the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit, given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people died before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late, and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public. France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of the Spotlight. Now, the Russian-Ukraine conflict has already had an immense impact on economic activities and inflation through higher energy and commodity prices. But recent developments suggest that it will also lead to a shift in international commerce as well by reinforcing the anti-dollar axis. Russia now wants what it calls unfriendly countries to pay for Russian gas in rubles, a demand that has sent European gas prices surging. Despite opposing to the move, it appears that the West has difficulty in circumventing an energy superpower. In this edition of Spotlight, we will be discussing the impact of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, particularly on global energy supply. Now, in this edition, we have two guests from New York and Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And I would like to start with our guest from New York. Now, Russia is insisting on receiving gas payments in rubles. To what extent do you think the currency switch is justified in the wake of sanctions imposed on Moscow?
Oh, it's extremely justified. I mean, the U.S. has seized Russian assets, at odds with its previous promises to exercise financial fiduciary responsibility with regard to those assets. And Russia is quite alarmed and therefore is clearly in the process of transferring itself out of dollar-based assets into ruble-based assets that presumably would be beyond the reach of U.S. financial authorities. And what's more important is that other nations are getting the same message and responding accordingly. So the so not only is political power breaking up around the globe, but financial power as well, as countries like China and Russia take steps to protect themselves against U.S. seizures of this sort.
Thank you. Now to our guests in Brussels. How much do you think this retaliatory move by Moscow would be effective, considering the explanations that we just heard?
I think it will be effective, because Europe has no choice. I think you have a lot of whistling in the dark here. People like Chancellor Scholz, who's giving a bright image to the possibilities of Germany and other European countries getting around Russian supplies, or the commissioner of the European Union, von der Leyen, who has instructed all member states of the European Union not to comply with the Russian demand. But that's total folly. The Russians have made it fairly clear that they will turn off the switch, which means that Europe will land in a disaster. The issue is not whether prices for gas will go up. They will go up. The question is, will there be any gas? And in the immediate days, weeks, and months, there will be no gas. And European industry will shut down. People in their homes will not have heating. And it's all completely unnecessary. It is pure stubbornness and the mistaken belief that Europe has greater leverage than Russia has with Europe. It will fail.
Back to New York. G7 countries have not accepted Russia's condition, and at least not just yet. Do you believe, like our guest from Brussels, that eventually they will have to?
Yes, I think that Russia has the upper hand. I mean, energy prices are rising, and that benefits energy exporters like Russia or the Persian Gulf states. So Russia has the advantage, and Europeans are at the disadvantage. So they'll have no choice. Their choices will be to face a drastic cutoff in energy supplies, which will lead their industry in ruins and will also lead to severe political, turmoil, or give in to Russian demands and begin paying for natural gas in rubles.
Okay, so all of this, I believe, is spelling a new economic world order. Let's go back to Brussels to Gilbert Doctorow, independent and international affairs analyst. So Putin is obviously not isolated despite the Western sanctions. At least in Asia, we know that he has a handful of partners that support its de-dollarization policies. Are you looking at a new economic world order here?
Well, I believed from the very beginning of this conflict that a new world order would emerge. I have to admit that I didn't anticipate it would take precisely the form it's taking. I expected there would be a bipolar world with Europe and the United States on one side and Russia and China on the other. What I see now forming is a constellation of the West, headed by the United States, with the European Union, with the UK, Canada, Australia, and a few other odd countries, facing against the Russia, China, India, and the Global South. Now, the Indian element here is extremely important and could not be anticipated. Everyone was talking about China. It was China, China, China. The Chinese are backing Putin, and the support from President Xi made the whole invasion possible. However, in terms of real, open, and transparent assistance, Russia has benefited much more in recent days from India, because Russia and India concluded an agreement whereby the now fast expanding Russian sales of crude oil to India will be settled in rupees. And the rupees will be used by the Russians to invest in Indian state bonds. Now, if you look at it, that is essentially the type of formula that lay behind the petrodollar from the 1970s. So the uniqueness of the American dollar as the world's reserve currency is being challenged directly in the latest agreements between India and Russia, and we may expect them to be a model for future agreements between Russia and China.
Now, thank you very much. Mr. Lazar, as we just heard Mr. Doctorow pointing out to the fact that we were expecting a Russia-China partnership, but joining that partnership is now India. There is also Turkey and Iran in the line. So India has reportedly expressed interest in an alternative to SWIFT, and that would allow it to trade with countries under U.S. sanctions. All this is pointing to a very big shift. Do you believe that this is possible? How likely is it to happen?
Oh, it's very possible. And I think the more the U.S. pushes, the likelier it will be. SWIFT essentially is a giant email system, which allows members to engage in financial transactions, you know, across the globe with a few clicks of the mouse. But the U.S. controls it, and the U.S. had previously run it in a relatively objective, neutral fashion. But the politicization of SWIFT, which has occurred since the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, shows the U.S. is not going to do that anymore. So therefore, it makes it all the more urgent for other countries which don't want to, you know, be at the mercy of U.S. Financial blackmail to establish an alternate system that they will control, that will accomplish the same ends, but will do so while removing the threat of U.S. political interference.
Well, thank you very much. Back to Mr. Doctorow. Now, let's discuss something that is very important at this point. How do you assess U.S. efforts to lessen European countries' dependence on Russian gas?
Well, that has been a stated U.S. objective since early in the Trump administration. There's nothing new in that. The question is, to what extent the United States can provide the gas, which is limited. It takes time to ramp up production and to add super tankers to carry the gas. And at the end of the day, everyone knows that turbine gas, that pipeline gas, is much cheaper intrinsically than the compressed liquid gas. That is simply a question of transport costs. The liquefaction and the regasification, all of those are expensive and capital-intensive operations. So the United States plan was fine words, but it's not easy to follow through on them.
So, Mr. Lazar, adding to that, let's also point to the Persian Gulf littoral states and the comments that have been made recently by countries like Qatar, the UAE. Well, they're obviously not capable of replacing Russian gas, and they're not willing to either. We just heard from Qatar that said it will not be able to replace Russian gas, and also OPEC Plus did not back this policy. So what does this spell for Europe?
I think the U.S. is in big trouble. I mean, I think we're seeing the eclipse of U.S. global hegemony. Shortly after the invasion, there was a vote in the UN General Assembly, to condemn Russia for its actions. And really, three-fourths of the world's population vote either abstained or voted no on that resolution. So the U.S. is facing a huge rebellion, a huge mutiny, a global mutiny against its power. And the reason is very simple. I mean, the U.S. has been on a rampage for 25 years. Its behavior has been hypocritical in the extreme. Everybody knows that. And I might add, the people of Iran know that especially. And so everyone knows that, and people have reached the breaking point. They are just tired of it. They don't want to put up with it any longer. And now the system is coming apart at the seams. And so I think we're seeing the breakup of the old order and a crystallization of a new kind of financial structure.
Now, this question is one that I would like both of you to answer. What other options do Europeans have in terms of energy supplies? Mr. Doctorow.
Commit suicide. What they're doing now is extremely foolhardy, and I can't believe the incompetence of European leadership. But when you look at them one by one, you begin to understand. Who are these people? Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission, she is by education a gynecologist. Her knowledge of economics is obviously close to zero. And she has usurped the power of the sovereign state members of the European Union to instruct them not to buy Russian gas for rubles. This is madness. You look at the single biggest member state in terms of economy, Germany, and Chancellor Scholz. He was the mayor of Hamburg, and his mental breadth width is that of a German mayor. He had zero experience as a federal administrator, and he's speaking in a mindless way. His cabinet, which was put together by opportunism to get to seize power, and by bringing in Greens and others who have no common agenda with his own party, was only opportunistic. And the result is total incompetence. Unfortunately, that is a widespread situation in Europe, and it explains the lemming behavior that we see now. I think of last week's crash of the Chinese 737. It went straight down. And that's what Europe is doing now. It is going vertically down and accelerating.
So, Mr. Lazar, you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I do. I'd phrase it a bit differently. Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, was the candidate of the German Socialist Party, the Social Democrats. This is the same party which in 1914 essentially agreed to the support the war effort of Kaiser Wilhelm, plunging Europe into a world war which led to something on the order of 10 million deaths. Essentially, the Social Democrats in the person of Olaf Scholz are doing the same thing. They are going along with Joe Biden's war drive. They are not raising a peep of opposition. And this war drive, if allowed to continue, will plunge Europe into the same kind of catastrophe.
So you also, like Mr. Doctorow, believe that Europeans have no other options?
They do have options. Their option is to put an end to this madness, to try to push for a negotiated settlement in the Ukraine, and one which respects Russia's entirely legitimate security concerns and also tackles the problem of rampant neo-Nazism in the Western Ukraine.
Okay, so Mr. Doctorow, you talked about how Europeans are nosediving, but the main question for all of us outside Europe is how will any fallout affect global energy prices? Should we prepare ourselves for oil prices above $200 per barrel?
Look, the former energy minister that served for 10 years in that capacity in Russia, Mr. Novak, who is today the deputy prime minister, said a couple of weeks ago that if Europeans continue to behave as they are now, the price of a barrel will be $300. And he knows a lot better the economics of the oil business, much better than Madame von der Leyen or Mr. Scholz or Mr. Macron. They all are amateurs.
Okay, and Mr. Lazar, your opinion, should we look at oil prices above $200 per barrel or $300, as our other guest suggested?
I'm very bad when it comes to financial predictions like that. But yes, I think the price will continue upward as these tensions mount. I mean, U.S. policy since 1980 has been to control the global energy markets by controlling the Persian Gulf, and that is now falling apart as not only Iran but also the Gulf states, you know, look to allies in China and Russia, and the U.S. finds itself shut out. So the U.S. is facing a failure all around in the Gulf, in the energy markets in general, in the European Union. Joe Biden is really on the edge of the precipice.
And as you mentioned, we are looking at a multipolar economy rather than a bipolar or even one simply controlled by the United States. Mr. Doctor, would you like to comment on that, this multipolar scene that we're looking at?
Well, exactly the constellation is difficult to predict. But I'd like to add one further comment to my remarks on the incompetence of European leaders. No country has a monopoly on stupidity. And I think we have to take a look back to Washington and who is sitting in the Oval Office. We have a half-wit. We have a senile president. And his handlers know that. And when he makes these stupid, offensive, and potentially inflammatory remarks that he's made about the leader of the world's other nuclear superpower, watch out. We are in very dangerous territory.
Okay, and Mr. Lazar, are we looking at a multipolar economic system now? And who are these economic powers in the new order?
Oh, we are definitely looking at a multipolar economic system. And the powers will be China first and foremost, Russia in terms of energy, India, which is clearly a rising economic power, and that is proceeding hand in hand with the breakup of political power as well. I mean, look at if India sides with China, then the so-called Quad, which was the anti-Chinese alliance the U.S. is assembling in the Western Pacific, that obviously will be in ruins. So U.S. policy is failing there as well. I mean, Joe Biden is really an incompetent who has overplayed his hand, and the U.S. is really teetering on the edge of a major disaster.
Thank you very much, Mr. Doctorow. To wrap up this discussion, would you like to also tell us who you think will be global economic powers in this new economic system?
Well, let me just clarify. Yes, Russia will be a major power in the energy field. That is dictated by resources, competences, and markets. However, it would be unrealistic at this stage to speak about Russia as a major economic power. It simply has too much to do to expand its industrial base, to fill in all of the holes in its products and technologies and services, which were till now filled in by Western suppliers. So the major powers economically will be, of course, the United States. That goes without question. It's India, China, and a number of other countries, including assuming that the difficulties Iran is experiencing are overcome, there will be more players, not in the first league, but in the second league. And they will have an influence on the working of the board of directors of the globe.
Well, thank you very much. That was Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. And we also had with us Daniel Lazar, journalist and author out in New York. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts on this edition of The Spotlight.
My pleasure.
And thanks for following us.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in the previous episode, you heard the story of Imam Khomeini's residence in the holy city of Qom with Lady Khadija Saqafi, whose father was one of the renowned ulema in Tehran. Today, we will touch upon Imam Khomeini's simple way of living according to his wife. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini's fourth house in Qom was much smaller than the previous ones. It was in the poor neighborhood of the city. After 3 years of residing in the third house, the Imam had to leave to somewhere else. Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Sadiq Lavasani, who used to help Imam Khomeini in such affairs, tried to find a new house for him. Due to the Imam's poverty, he had to rent a smaller house. Lady Khadija Saqafi says in this regard, Mr. Ruhollah Khomeini had found it better to do so. He was right. There was no income after all. I mean, it was not regular and continuous. He would not get the stipend either. And there was no other money. When he had seen this house, it seems that he didn't like it. He came and told me, You two go and see it. I said, no, it is okay for me if you like it. I wish I had gone and seen it. In that case, I would not step in that house. When he had told Mr. Sayyid Sadiq that the house was not suitable, he asked why. The rent of this house is 3 tomans per month, while the current house is 5 tomans. Is it bad to save 2 tomans every month? Khadija Saqafi was a patient and rational woman. Thus, she didn't disagree and never disputed with the Imam to pressure him. She lived in this humble house from the age of 19 to 27. Yet, she never complained, as she knew well that her husband was in economic pressure. She relates, on those years, Mr. Ruhollah knew my temperament well and knew how to behave to calm me. I always lived with him sincerely and purely. He would always compensate our poverty with kindness and expression of love. Of course, he never believed that we were in bad condition because the condition of the students at that time was worse than ours. The Imam believed that one is not poor as long as he doesn't eat carrion. He would tell me, thank God, we have always been well off. Imam Khomeini had such a lofty spirit that he didn't let the robbers of their house be exposed and insulted among people. He told his wife, "They're good people and the robbery had originated in their need. We should pardon them." She pardoned them verbally, but the imam told her that she had to forgive them in her heart. In a similar incident, a woman had stolen Lady Saghafi's handbag in Najaf. The lady knew her and wanted to pursue her and get back the handbag and its contents. But Imam Khomeini dissuaded her, as he was very careful to not to tarnish people's repute. He knew that the woman was poor and he didn't like to disgrace her among people. This spirit of forgiveness was in circumstances that Ruhollah and Khadija had economic problems themselves. Lady Khadija had become weak when she was expecting her third child. She says, "At the time of Ahmad's birth, I was so weak that I couldn't even moan. And at the moment of childbirth, there was no one except my 9-year-old daughter. As soon as seeing my fainting, Sadiqa had run and informed her father, saying that I had died. It was at the midnight that I regained my consciousness of the pain in my neck. I saw that Mr. Ruhollah was massaging my neck vessels. I opened my eyes but fainted again. This happened several times, but I had no ability to talk because I had not eaten anything for several days." Imam Khomeini and his wife were so magnanimous that they never asked anyone for financial help, despite dire need. Lady Khadija relates a memoir on this. When she had gone to Tehran for her stomach ulcer, she had paid a visit to her sister, whose husband was a colonel. As she saw Khadija's son, Ahmad, in poor condition, she told her, "What kind of life is this? Winter, snow, and tattered shoes." Khadija was very upset and could not forget those bitter remarks for years. Imam Khomeini was in poor economic conditions, but he would not give up worship and studying. Lady Khadija says, "The whole thought and love of Mr. Ruhollah was studying and teaching. He used to wake up for midnight prayer. Then he would be engaged in studying and then teaching till night, that he would sleep again. He had said several times, 'I do not prefer anything to my ritual duties and studying.'" Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini was a very kind person with his family. He would never let the family affected by daily debates between him and his wife. He would always be the first to solve differences and make peace. Ms. Fatema Tabatabai, Imam Khomeini's daughter-in-law and wife of Haj Ahmad, says in this regard that when she and Haj Ahmad had gone to visit the imam for the first time after marriage, he left them for midnight prayer. He told them, "You can speak with the lady, my wife. I have to take care of my affair." Ms. Tabatabai says, "I asked Ahmad in surprise when the imam had gone. Ahmad answered that he had gone for midnight prayer. I had expected him to be more with his daughter-in-law and grandson, whom he was visiting for the first time, but he told us to rest as we could visit him again the following day." Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.